Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Dennis Hart, your host for today, together with Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you so much for listening in.
Welcome, and thanks for joining us.
And Ursula, indeed, it looks like we're easing gradually into cooler weather with the accompanying variable weather conditions. We've had rain showers, sometimes heavy during the first part of today, but sunny skies are expected by evening. Temperatures should stay warm in the lower 80s. Tuesday, expected to be mostly cloudy with temperatures in the high 70s, with showers and thunderstorms likely, which should continue throughout the night. Again on Wednesday and Wednesday night, showers and thunderstorms with a high near 70. The rainy trend will continue through Thursday, although the sun will likely reappear by afternoon and remain through Friday. Temperatures will be in the high 60s. The National Weather Service, noncommittal about Saturday, or whether it's going to be rainy or sunny. But by Sunday, they predict sunny skies and temperatures back up in the 70s. We begin this broadcast with some unfortunately horrendous news from overnight. More than 50 people have been killed and at least 200 others injured after a gunman opened fire last night at a country music festival opposite the Mandalay Bay Hotel and Resort on the Las Vegas Strip. Police released the updated death toll in the early morning hours after a horrific night of violence that turned a concert into a scene of carnage. Police say the suspect, 64-year-old Stephen Paddock, a resident of Mesquite, Nevada, was killed after a SWAT team burst into the hotel room from which he was firing at the crowd on the 32nd floor. They believe that he was a lone gunman, that there was no plot. At least that is the initial word we're getting out of Las Vegas. The gunman appeared to have started firing at 10:08 p.m. Pacific time. That's 12:08 a.m. this morning in Iowa, from the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay Hotel toward the concert venue across the street. Officers entered the room from which the gunman was firing and shot him to death. Police say they have succeeded in locating a woman identified as Mary Lou Danley, who is believed to be traveling with Paddock and is listed as living at his address in Mesquite, which is about 80 miles northeast of Las Vegas. We are confident we have located the female person of interest, the sheriff's department says. This is the deadliest mass shooting in the history of this country. Again, at least 50 people killed, 200 wounded in a mass shooting on the Vegas Strip overnight out west. Two of the dead may include a pair of off-duty police officers who were attending the concert. A grim way, we're afraid, to start this broadcast and start this week, Ursula.
Yep.
So now, what do you have from the Iowa Informer's Weekly News Roundup?
On Friday, State Treasurer Michael Fitzgerald, who's a Democrat, sent a letter to Republican Governor Kim Reynolds claiming that her plan to balance the state budget using $13 million from the Iowa Economic Emergency Fund, quote, would not be in compliance with Iowa law, unquote. The dispute involves varying interpretations of a law that allows the governor to transfer up to $50 million in emergency funds without legislative approval, only if the estimate of the, quote, general fund receipts, unquote, during the fiscal year's final quarter is, quote, at least one-half of 1% less than the comparable estimate made during the third quarter of the fiscal year, unquote. So that should appeal to the nerd in all of us. Otherwise, Reynolds may be forced to call a special legislative session to resolve the budget shortfall. Last week, the Associated Press revealed details of how former Board of Regents President Bruce Rastetter was holding a series of meetings in July in 2015 at his Ames business office with Bruce Harreld, whom the board later controversially hired as the University of Iowa's new president. By holding multiple meetings with Harreld, a former IBM executive, the board was able to avoid having a majority of its members present at any single time, which would have required public disclosure. The details emerged in deposition board members gave in response to a lawsuit that they allegedly violated the state's open meeting law. Rastetter testified that he didn't consider the meeting an official Board of Regents matter, and that he scheduled the meetings to specifically make sure we were in compliance with the law. He also said he arranged the meetings at the urging of businessman Jerry Stead, a university donor. No other presidential candidates received similar treatment. In response to President Trump's recent comments on NFL players who kneel in protest of racism during the national anthem should be fired, team and owners from across the league joined together last week to kneel, link arms, or stay in the locker rooms during the anthem to defy the president. Senator Chuck Grassley from Iowa said, when a knee is involved, I figure the only time you should get on your knees is to pray. Senator Joni Ernst said she respected the protesters' right to free speech, but added she had the right to stop watching football in response. Governor Kim Reynolds called the protests so disrespectful to military veterans. The protests began in 2016 when San Francisco 49er quarterback Colin Kaepernick took a knee in protest of police violence against African Americans. University of Iowa football coach Kirk Ferentz also weighed in, saying he supported his players protesting but not on the field. Matt Campbell, head coach of the Iowa State Cyclones, struck a different note, saying he would support his players if they chose to protest. In a tweet, his wide receiver, Alan Lazard, encouraged players to take a knee, although Cyclones don't take the field until after the anthem is finished. And that's a cross-section of the weekly news roundup from the Iowa Informer. You can find more at iowainformer.com. And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host today with Dennis Hart.
Well, Ursula, October, as we know, has started, and with it, another run of pretend, and we emphasize pretend, terror and mayhem on 4th Street. Now, you may think it's a bit too early to think about Halloween, but not so. No, for the haunted forest across the street from the parking lot of Jack Trice Stadium down by Squaw Creek.
The haunted forest returns this coming weekend, starting Friday the 6th. Lynn Ballard, the owner, promises to all who visit the forest that they will have a ghoulish experience at every morbid turn. Lynn Ballard is with us by phone. Hello, Lynn. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, and we're just thrilled to be here.
Lynn, we have also one of your team here at the station. Would you care to introduce Bailey and tell us a little bit who she is as well?
Great. The Haunted Forest has been a family tradition, and we've got four generations. Our father, or Bailey's grandfather, started this. And Bailey is my brother, Lee's daughter, who is also part of the management team. And Bailey's been active since she was born, as we've started, I think this is our 19th season. And Bailey was there shortly after she was born. So, Bailey, thank you for all you do for the Haunted Forest.
Oh, thank you for having me here.
Bailey, you've had a rough childhood.
I have.
These people have been scaring you since you were how old?
Since I was one. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Bailey and Lynn, would you describe the haunted forest? Tell us what's going on down there in the woods.
Well, basically, we started. We're very fortunate to have ample parking in a forest wooded area. We've been voted Iowa's number one haunted attraction for the past 15 years. What our customers experience is the 15 to 20 minute walk through the woods. They're going to see the typical chainsaws, mazes, clowns, ghosts, witches, and our theme always was don't come alone. A lot of new unexpected things this year. We're fortunate. We hire between 25 and 30 Iowa State actors that bring a very, very professional atmosphere. Many of them are in plays, drama, so we're thrilled to have the Iowa State actors support us every year.
Bailey, tell us who Mango Zombie is.
He was actually an Iowa State student that worked for us, and he created animatronic zombie that he could like run with technology. And so he was a really good actor and important asset we had for a couple of years, creating not only that, but other scenes in the haunted forest, just little scares, or even the Mango Zombie was a real big hit just for entertainment to the people coming through the forest every year.
And is Mango the zombie still there?
He is not, but he has left some of the stuff that he created with us to keep using after he left.
Lynn mentioned that they use Iowa State students to basically populate the haunted forest. Tell us a little bit about that. Who does this? Do we have repeaters every year who come and do this?
Yeah, we do have people that come back every year bringing their own new and creative ideas, but we also have new people that just are excited to scare people on the weekends during Halloween time. But it's just any Iowa State student. Some people are in drama clubs, or some people just get some of their friends to do it.
So people bring their own acts?
Yeah. We have.
I mean, act, not acts.
Yeah, we have costumes, makeup for them too, but a lot of them have their own ideas coming into it just because they're so excited about it. But
So welcome them improvising on their own.
Yeah, we encourage them to, if they have something they want to do, then We are all for it.
So is this planned mayhem or is this spontaneous? Do you know what happens out there?
We have like a set of where they're going to be, but every mm-hmm. night it's different on who's there and what they want to dress up as. So uh-huh. yeah, it can change from night to night, but we kind of have a set, I would say, theme overall.
What do you do?
I'm more of like a behind the scenes kind of thing. Each night making sure actors have their costumes on, they know what spot they're going to be in, just making sure everything's running smoothly before we open, stuff like that.
And Lynn, who is the Phantom of the Bayou and what is his domain?
Well, the Phantom of the Bayou was created by a gentleman from Texas that helped us get started. He has more or less roamed before us, part of the unexpected. That's we like the customer to wait to see what they can expect as it changes every night. People have had a lot of different experiences with this. And as Bailey said, the themes change every year because we encourage all the actors to bring, whether it's a theme from this new movie, Clowns, It is a hit. You know, when we had Jason with the chainsaw. So those are things that have made our attraction so good.
And we're speaking with Lynn and Bailey Ballard, who are with The Haunted Forest, which is a Halloween feature that apparently got 5 out of 5 pumpkins on iowahauntedhouse.com.
It's amazing. We'll get buses from anywhere from a 50 to 100 mile radius that come every year, and it's just overwhelming.
How does a family get into this profession?
Well, in our case, the entertainment factor, my dad, Bailey's grandfather, was the magician. And I think looking back to when he was really the instigator to do this, he was the owner of the property. My mom and dad had Riverside Manor Nursing Home in Ames in the 60s. And that's where the property actually came from, across the creek from the nursing home. And he decided to keep it. And in conversation with a gentleman from Texas that does haunted attractions in Texas, it was kind of an overnight decision to let's go with it, and we've been going ever since. Two families involved, myself and my brothers, their kids, grandkids.
And again, you've been there how long now?
This is our 19th season. So fortunate. We couldn't be happier with Ames, whether it's the student body at Iowa State, the kids from Ames, the families, the support from the city, the police department. Everybody has just been fantastic for us to keep the haunted forest going, and we're so grateful for that.
Now, this is seasonal work. Do you do something else to the rest of the year, or do you do other amusement?
Nope, this strictly is a hobby.
This is a hobby.
Very busy September. Yeah, this is a weekend hobby. Between all of our kids, I'm sure they can't wait for October to come, and they also can't wait for it to be over. It's interesting. Halloween is the other than Christmas, the second largest holiday that we celebrate here, and for us to have the opportunity with the forest there and to be able to do this, and it's a family effort. It takes all of us to get this thing ready to open and to keep it going.
So Bailey, when folks come there, you know, Lynn was saying they come from all over.
Yeah.
Now, when they go through this, do you hear crying or laughter, or is this at the end, is this funny, or is this truly horrifying? Or,
well, I mean, you hear everything. There's people laughing, screaming, crying. I don't think anything's, like, serious. I think they're all just enjoying it, having a good time. I know it's fun to hear the screams and stuff. I mean, then we know we're doing our job right.
Do you have an age limit? Do you ever have children that get really scared?
Yeah, we don't really have an age limit, just kind of up to their parents or
mm-hmm.
whatever. Yeah, I mean, we have young kids that come through, and sometimes they enjoy it just as much as their parents do. But
uh-huh.
yeah, it's just kind of up to the parents if they want to let their kids go through. But
and finally, Lynn, since you're the expert on fear, or maybe you too, Bailey, because you've grown up with it, why do people like to be scared? Why do they travel so far just to get scared?
Well, I don't know. There's people the comment when they leave us is, where's another haunted forest or haunted house close? And it was interesting when Bailey said the age, you know, we have college kids that get part way out and come back. It's amazing how many people that we run through, and you just really can't explain those that make it all the way. But we have several every night that can't go through the entire forest, and we'll have actors that have to escort people out. But as a rule, most of them make it through.
Okay, and we're speaking with Lynn Ballard, who owns the Haunted Forest down on 4th Street, across the street from the stadium parking lot. Last words, Bailey and Lynn, where is your website where folks can look up your location and hours if they're interested?
Yeah, our website is ameshauntedforest.com. And, yeah, on there you can see our hours, nights open. We have coupons on there, too, and just other general information about it, anyone that wants to check it out.
Okay, and Lynn, we'll give you the last word here.
I'll just, first, it's thank you so much for having us on the air. I want to remind everybody we're family. It's a very safe environment. We get kids that are dropped off there at 7 o'clock, and they're there till 9 or 10 o'clock.
Wow.
Our hours are at 7, but just more than anything, thanks for the support from Ames we've had the last 19 years. And with any help, and if Bailey keeps going, we can be there 19 more years.
Okay, Bailey, you're stuck with a life of fear.
I guess.
And it's also apparently a tradition among some Iowa State students who come and express their own inner ghoul once a year. So it's a very, very interesting thing going on down there by the river.
We've had people that have had proposals. We've had to stop the line. They've carved in pumpkins. Will you marry me? We've had people that have asked to get married there. So we've had a great following.
Also, you're having an owl display there.
We in the past few years, we've invited from Iowa State, I believe it's Injured Birds, as a fundraiser. They take donations. So we've done a lot of different things with different organizations, you know, because of the crowd and the kids that we get. So, yeah, we're open to any of that. If there's an organization or a group that would like to promote what they're doing, we welcome that.
Thank you, and thank you, Bailey, for coming by.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Visitation by Ralph Towner. And if you've just joined us, this is Local Talk. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for today, here together with Dennis Hart. Jennifer Brockpoller has joined us. Jennifer is director of the Ames Community Arts Council, our community organization that brings together those in Ames in the arts. Every year, the Ames Community Arts Council, or ACAC, as we call it, organizes the opportunity for you to be invited into artists-owned studios in the area. And that's coming right up. Welcome, Jennifer.
Good to be here.
Tell us what's happening. What is the studio tour?
In less than a week, 15 artists here found here in Ames, all sorts of mediums, everything from pottery, glassmakers, woodworkers. We have the ARC recording studio downtown is on the studio tour this year. They will open their doors and people can come in and walk around and basically watch them make art. It's a rare opportunity to get into people's homes. That's the cool thing about Ames. A lot of folks, you know, in the bigger cities, there might be a studio, but in Ames, a lot of folks are making art in their own homes. So it's great to go and see where this art process is happening. So they open their homes to us, and on Saturday, October 7th, from 10 a.m. till 4 p.m., and on Sunday, the 8th, from noon to 4, you can walk through, talk to people about their process, talk to them about what they do in their studios all year long, and if we're lucky, you'll find that perfect piece to bring back to your home.
So they're also selling works in their
studios. They are. Mm-hmm. They're selling works. They're doing demonstrations. Lots of folks have treats. Lots of folks have things that are appropriate. And I guess I should back up and say it is appropriate for the whole family. We, of course, want you to be watching your children as they walk through a pottery studio. But these artists are willing to show kids how to throw clay on the wheel, or Art Ciccotti does a wonderful glass blowing demonstration during the tour. He's making art as you walk through, so it's just gorgeous.
Now, when somebody's on this tour, how does one actually do it?
That's the magic. It's you're at your own power. You use your own transportation, so you can go to as many or as few of the studios as you'd like. So you drive around, and honestly, every studio is marked. There's a nice sign in the front that says studio tour participant, so you know you're in the right place. And then you truly just walk in. They're expecting you. They want you there. Then you walk around and do your thing. Even the studio, we're so excited that KHOI is on the tour again this year. That's another interesting thing about the Ames area studio tour. Often when you see these, they're usually pottery and painting, but because the Ames arts community is so interesting and varied, we try to represent everyone. So we get the radio station, like I mentioned, we have the recording studio downtown as well.
And you have the design?
Design on Main.
Design on Main.
Will be a part of the studio tour this year. They've got Mary Mallow will be displaying her work. And the new artist in residence, Catherine Reinhardt, we'll have her studio open so you can watch her. She's a beautiful fiber artist. I think there's 5 studios just in downtown alone.
So does one get a map, or how does one know how to find these?
There is a map available online, amesart.org. It's at the
AmesArt.org.
top. AmesArt.org. You can find a map and a printable brochure there, or I've got them distributed throughout town.
Them out in front here at KHOI at 410 Douglas. Yes, we have a storefront, so you can just stop by and pick one up here.
Yes, there's one here. And our headquarters during the tour is Worldly Goods. So if you have any questions along the way, if you get somewhere and you get confused, the folks there know a lot about the tour and they can answer your questions and get you back where you need to be.
Mm-hmm. How long has this tour been going on?
The Arts Council has been doing it for at least 4 years, but it's not it was before that CASA was really involved and helped to organize it, the Creative Artist Studio of Ames, which is another great venue to visit on the tour. Mm-hmm. They did it for a few years before that. I think it's been kind of an on and off, on again, off again event. But now that it's a part of the Arts Council, since we serve as an umbrella organization, we can market and do things for everyone in an organized way. We're going to keep it going.
How many studios are there in the whole tour?
There's 15 this year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you could conceivably, if you really were interested, you could see all of them. You've done it in the space of 2 days?
Yes, you really can. Of course, you have to budget your time, but it is possible to see everything. But you don't have to. If you find that you're having a great time in one space, you can stay as long as you want.
How long do you find people generally do stay at a
30 minutes, mm-hmm. 20, 30 minutes. It really does depend on what you find. Like a tour of the studio here at KHOI, you can tour the studio. They'll let you – I've heard rumor that they'll let you be on the radio or record something for later. So that could take a little bit of time.
Yeah, or we can let you play with the equipment, show you how it works.
It's so cool in here, guys. You got to see it.
It is. We have a very pretty studio, don't we?
It is a beautiful studio.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. And it has a work of art in it. It has a quilt in it that was made just for us.
Well, and the community mural is always something neat to see. Like mm-hmm. you said, you have a beautiful storefront. So whether you come for the studio tour or just because you can, come and check out the mural, talk to the folks at the front. Everybody's so nice here.
Yeah, come and visit us here at KHOI on Saturday or Sunday, and we will have somebody here to show you around. We love to show off our studio, which was made by volunteers here in Ames. Yeah. Tell us about another studio you visited, Jennifer, that you really enjoyed.
That's a lot of pressure. It's like picking a favorite child.
I know. It's kind of unfair.
It is.
Let's say it's not your favorite. It's just one of the ones.
One of the ones. I mentioned Art Ciccotti. His is a beautiful studio because he's actually it's a neat thing to see people blow glass. So that is a really mm-hmm. neat process. The Creative Artist Studios of Ames – over on in the campus town area, it's cool because you can see three or four or five artists in the same spot. You land there and then you can walk around and talk to. And they're primarily pottery and painting. So you can see two mediums in one place.
Now, Art Ciccotti, he's actually in Napier, right?
Yes. So he's on the edges.
So the tour is kind of Ames and surrounding.
Ames area.
Ames area.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Art's probably the farthest out, although we've got an artist on every corner. That's when we were building the map. We're like, oh, nope, we have to go way north. Oh, nope, we have to go way west.
Is Napier the farthest away?
Probably. Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the new artists on the studio tour, and I'm excited about her, is Linda Hardy. She's over by the lake, I'm blanking.
Lake Laverne?
No. Ada Hayden, thank you. She's over by Ada Hayden, and she's brand new into town, so she's really excited about being a part of the tour. And her space is a beautiful kind of a machine shed studio where she and her husband both work. And they've only been in Ames a couple of years, so to be a part of this, she's excited to have people in her home for the first time. Same with a beautiful potter, Erin Carpenter. This is her first open studio ever. So they're learning with you what this is supposed to feel like and look like. But Erin does this beautiful, airy pottery. She carves these beautiful things, and you have to wonder how they get through the kiln because how it doesn't break as she's doing it. Uh-huh. I think she said sometimes she's surprised too that it makes it. But she has some beautiful things, and this is the first time that she's doing something like this. I will note, just because Erin's studio made me think of it, not all of the studios are accessible. So you do want to watch the map if accessibility is an issue for you, if getting around stairs, if stairs aren't possible. Some of the studios might be too hard. Jennifer Drinkwater, for example, I know her studio is in the upstairs of her garage. Mm-hmm. But those are all marked on the map.
So the map tells you which ones are accessible and which ones aren't.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So you should be able to tell. And of course, if you get somewhere that you aren't able to get where you need to go, I'm sure the artist will still come and talk to you about what they're making.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just something to note.
For artists who have done this for quite a while, what has been their experience? What have they told you what it means to them to do it?
They always start by joking that, well, I had to clean the studio.
That's right.
So it's that yearly excuse to straighten up. And so they appreciate that. But then really, they all appreciate the opportunity to meet their patron face to face. Not a lot of art is sold during the studio tour. They know that.
So they're not looking. They don't expect you to come and buy.
Right. They're not expecting you to spend a lot of money. But they're hoping you might meet them. You might build a relationship, understand how they work. And, you know, we buy things like art from our friends if we can. And so they're hoping to build, like I said, build that relationship to make that happen at a later date. And they do make some good sales. They do sometimes find that perfect person to take a piece off their
hands. And what kind of comments do you hear from the visitors?
They're always surprised at how much there is here. I think people, you know, there's so many hidden gems in Ames. And so this is really an opportunity to understand art is happening behind almost every closed door here in the city. Mm-hmm. My family came from Des Moines and Pleasant Hill, and they were so, you know, there's nothing like that going on where they live. So to be mm-hmm. able to walk through and see what's happening here is really exciting for them.
Mm-hmm. And why it's a pretty big effort. Why does ACAC do this? Why?
The love of the game. It's so exciting to bring all these artists together and to know that you're helping them to create a livelihood mm-hmm. making art mm-hmm. and opening the doors. Is artists by nature are very quiet people, not always, but sometimes. And so it's a chance for them to have a reason to invite people in. As a community building organization, the Arts Council is always trying to build those, give those people those opportunities to meet each other and appreciate art.
Mm-hmm. And we're speaking with Jennifer from the Ames Arts Council, Jennifer Brockpoller. And thank you so much for coming in. Jennifer, what's the website? Where can people find out more about this?
It's pretty simple. It's amesart.org. And there's a link right at the top of the page right now.
Okay. Thank you so much. And if you've just joined us, this was Jennifer Brockpoller, Director of Ames Community Arts Council, talking about the upcoming studio tour. Thanks, Jennifer. Any last
word? Thank you. I hope you're able to come out. I'm hoping the weather cooperates. It was beautiful last year. We're hoping for the same. Check us out.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Local Talk, and I'm Dennis Hart, back as one of your hosts for this hour, together with Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for joining us. Our guest now, Ames City Councilwoman Bronwyn Beattie Hansen. Thank you for being here with your monthly update on Ames City government. Came in on a rainy day, and you got in. All right.
Yep, I made it on my bike, not too wet.
So. Very good. Very good. Well, we have a number of things to talk about. A lot of issues at the City Council, and probably the most important immediate one, in my estimation, is the rental rules issue. You at the council gave your first approval Tuesday night to an ordinance that would freeze the issuance of rental permits in neighborhoods near ISU and keep existing rentals from enlarging their properties all for about 6 months. So I guess the first question is, why did the council do this only for the areas around ISU and not for the entire city?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. I think that is where, for one, that's where the neighborhoods are that are the most concerned about the effect of rental occupancy on their stability, we'll say. Basically the neighborhoods that are student-heavy are the ones where we are hearing the most concern from citizens. And so we originally had thought about doing the moratorium citywide. But on Tuesday, we did narrow it down to those neighborhoods near campus. Just because basically we see that's where the problem is, and I don't know that we see that that students will flock necessarily to other parts of the city in the 6 months of the moratorium.
We should indicate that the reason the city has to do this is because of a state law that takes effect January 1st, which does away with your ability, our ability in Ames, to regulate on the basis of family members in a building. And so now you have to come up with a whole new set of rules.
Yes, exactly.
So you're taking the step to freeze things for 6 months. What's going to happen during that six-month period? Where does the council go from here?
Yeah, good question. So, yes, the 6 months is really just to buy us time to wrap our heads around what we're going to do long-term. It's definitely not meant to be our long-term strategy. Probably the next steps will be how to regulate rental occupancy in ways other than based on familial status. Some of the options that we had heard about or that we're thinking about would be maybe regulating or restricting rental occupancy based on just number of adults or based on number of students or based on the square footage of the house, perhaps, or the number of bedrooms in the house. Those would all be ways that it is still legal to regulate rental occupancy. And so I imagine we'll think about all of those methods and hopefully in 6 months we can all agree on one that we think will work well for Ames.
It's a very complex issue. Where do you have any feelings right now that you can talk about anyway in terms of the way you'd like to see the council go in future regulations, or is it a bit too early?
It's a little early. I think I have a sense that we have a sense that we don't necessarily, and again, this could all change. This is just a guess. But I don't have the sense that we would regulate just based on straight number of adults, say. That was an option. So you could say, oh, no more than, say, three adults in any rental house. That doesn't work for a number of reasons. But, you know, really, I think it comes down to defining a modern family, really. You know, you have different ways that a family looks, and we don't want to be too restrictive where you have, say, you have two adults living in a home and maybe their parents want to come back and live with them for some reason. Well, that would put you over the three, but it seems like a legitimate living situation. And so there are circumstances where just the pure number of adults doesn't seem realistic for regulating rental occupancy, whereas I think it's probably a little more likely that council would decide based on something that's going to be, for one, easy to define and regulate. So, you know, what comes to mind there would be square footage of the building or number of bedrooms in the unit. It's a lot easier to regulate that than it is to, say, limit to a certain number of adults or a certain number of students.
When you finally come up with your ultimate regulations, do you see them applying only to those areas around ISU or perhaps around the entire city?
I don't have a good guess for that. I could see we'll have to definitely discuss that. The arguments to be made for just having it in campus-affected areas would be that that's really where we see the issue. That's where the neighborhoods are reporting problems. And so it's really the area that is having the trouble. On the flip side of that, we want to make sure we're treating people fairly, too. So if a rental property owner is in one of those neighborhoods, but then, say, someone else owns a property across the street that's not in one of those defined areas, the person across the street would have an advantage if we don't somehow treat everyone, you know, fairly. So I think we need to look at that, and I don't know yet how council will fall on that one.
It's going to be tough. Good luck over the next few months on that one.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
Another issue that came up Tuesday night at the council meeting, The installation of security cameras in Campus Town. You approved it.
Mm-hmm.
And the money will come later. It's about $50,000 to put them in and $2,000 or $3,000 a year to maintain. May seem obvious, but for those who haven't followed this, why are those cameras needed out there?
Oh, good question. So Campus Town, as you can imagine, is a very lively area. And we have had some issues in the area, you know, certainly during during Visha, we had big issues in that area, but even since then, we've had some altercations, you know, fights, circumstances where people are, you know, in either physical danger or there's been property damage, and cameras would really allow the police to better conduct investigations in that area. And I think for areas like that, you know, the Ped Mall in Iowa City, for example, has a security system or a camera system. So it's not uncommon for, you know, public gathering places with as much volume as that area has to have some sort of security system in place.
Does the police department think that this will be a deterrent to crime or help them solve crime? Both? Or where do they fall on this one?
I think the police department is of the opinion that it's it will help them solve crimes. There's probably some research that would show it's a slight deterrent, but what I heard from them was that they think it would be more helpful after the fact and going back and reviewing footage. Another important distinction to make on that camera system is that it's not owned or it's not maintained by the police department, so there's not constant monitoring or surveillance of the area going on. It's actually a part of Iowa State's system, and Iowa State does have cameras all over campus already, so they already have this camera security system. And so we're going to incorporate this into their system. They'll essentially control that data, and then if the police need it to solve a particular specific crime, then they can come and request the footage from Iowa State. And so I think that helps allay some concerns, I guess, that people might have about monitoring of the footage.
It may surprise a lot of folks who haven't followed this that Iowa State students appear to be supportive of this. They're not opposed to it. You might think, well, they're young and they don't want to be recorded on the street, but they really are backing this, aren't they?
Yes. Yes, definitely. We've gotten several letters from the student government over the course of years that have supported this system. You know, I think students are living in a time where we've seen some big changes in expectations of privacy. Just the world of social media today, people, I think, already assume that they're being recorded already, you know, either on someone's social media or everybody's got cameras all the time. And so I think that doesn't concern students as much as it might have concerned a prior generation, I guess, because they're kind of used to it. And then also the fact that Iowa State owns the footage was something that they were supportive of, too, so that, again, that it's not constant monitoring but rather help in solving crimes.
Let's talk about the streets of Ames for
sure.
A couple of minutes here, a couple of issues. Lincoln Way Corridor. You approved received a report on the Lincoln Way Corridor implementation plan. What is that and what would that mean for Lincoln Way?
Right. Well, a while back now, we embarked on the Lincoln Way Corridor study where we picked several areas along Lincoln Way to look at. The idea is that we want to both improve transportation along the corridor, but also aesthetics and the sort of sense of place. You know, Lincoln Way looks very different when you're in downtown compared to Campus Town, for example, and we want to try to find some elements that can tie it together, make it feel more like one place. Really, the thing we approved, so the plan that we approved last Tuesday sets priorities for what we're going to work on first along Lincoln Way. We certainly can't tackle it all at once. And so the area we're going to prioritize on is the downtown gateway, we call that, which is between, essentially Duff and Grand or so along Lincoln Way. The south side of downtown, really, you know, if you were to head south from downtown. So that's our priority area in terms of getting some sort of project in that area, beautification, redevelopment, that kind of thing. We decided to wait on any changes to areas that are in neighborhoods that are campus affected. So as it relates to the rental housing changes, we didn't want to decide to go ahead with any changes along Lincoln Way in those areas because we don't know how, the rental restrictions will affect those areas. So those will be put on hold probably until we get the rental thing figured out.
Well, now, does this mean specifically on Lincoln Way that buildings might be demolished and new businesses built? I mean, we look at what happened in Campus Town, mm-hmm. where the original Campus Town structures were demolished, many of them, and now some new sky rises have gone in apartments. Is that what you're talking about on Lincoln Way?
Yes. I mean, it's not that we would leave up to a private entity, right? So it's not the city, wouldn't be the city's role to buy properties and redevelop them necessarily. But I think, the goal would be to work with someone who could redevelop the properties in that area as they become available or over time. It's not going to be instant for sure. We have existing businesses, obviously, that we don't want to displace either. But I think that's sort of already in the works, looking at those properties, consolidating them, trying to find out what might go well in that area. But that'll be, like I said, a private entity that the city is, working closely with.
Now you talk about improving transportation along Lincoln Way, and this ties in with your complete streets plan, which we also want to talk about.
Yeah.
But my question, my initial question is, does this mean with your complete streets plan that you're looking at changing those major arterials, Lincoln Way, Grand Avenue, Duff, to make them more bicycle-friendly and therefore squeeze automobiles on those arterials?
Oh, this is a great question, and it's one we get a lot of feedback about. The term road diet sets people into sort of a mad frenzy.
Indeed.
So I would be very careful how I answer that. I think...
And I was very careful in how I asked it.
appreciate that, yeah. I think there are certain roads that bicycles will never go well on. A Grand Avenue is, would be an example of that. It's a DOT or a state highway too, and you can't bike on it. Can't bike on the sidewalks. That's probably Grand is not in a position where we'd ever be able to change that. Some parts of Lincoln Way are similar, where there's just too high volume traffic to consider that. There are other parts of Lincoln Way where traffic studies might leave that more up to question, where there's enough traffic where, according to data, we might consider lane reductions. But again, we've gotten a lot of feedback on that one, so I think we'd have to proceed with caution.
Right.
And we don't want – so the goal of Complete Streets, to be really clear about that, is not to improve bicycle or pedestrian infrastructure at the expense of automobile traffic. That's not the goal, and that's not something we would want to do or that we'd want to use it for. So I think there are certainly parts of Lincoln Way where everyone would recognize it's no fun to walk down the sidewalk, or it's almost impossible to walk down the sidewalk, say, in the winter or if it's busy. So there are improvements that can be made even to those areas, I think, without necessarily lane reductions or anything like that. But I think it's important to look at how we can make the corridor more pedestrian-friendly, bicycle-friendly, even if it's just improving the existing sidewalks, say.
What about the other north-south major arterial, Duff Avenue, especially south of Lincoln Way? Do you see any prospect of – I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but the fear drivers would have is it's already congested down there.
Oh, yeah.
Do you see ever squeezing traffic into fewer lanes on Duff south of Lincoln Way?
I can't imagine traffic studies would support that, no. Duff is so high volume. I would say no, probably. That would not ever be in the plans. Regarding bicycle routes, too, it's not that we need – I say we just as a avid bicyclist myself, right? It's not that we need – Lincoln Way to be our east-west route. As long as there's a east-west route that's suitable, We can focus on that instead. So I would say, you know, we would work to, and this is just hypothetical, but we would work to make 6th Street, for example, or 15th or 20th better or more complete, so that we have at least a parallel route. But a complete streets policy doesn't necessarily mean that every single street is going to be usable by all modes. It just means that you have a network throughout your town that's complete for all modes somewhere.
And that was the point your consultant made at the council meeting. He said this is not an effort to get bikes on every street. Some neighborhood streets, for example, Old Town, et cetera, just aren't big enough.
Right.
And you've already got the curbs and the sidewalks in. You're not going to rip those up to create a lane for bikes.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah, and I think that's that's probably one of the bigger misconceptions about a complete streets plan. People think either A, that we'll make roads worse for automobiles, which again is not the goal, and or that we're, you know, working to put a bike lane on every street, which again isn't the case. We really just want to work with the networks we have, make them more complete.
Yeah. Well, your job is not easy. We have a couple of minutes left here to talk. I've asked you questions. Is there anything you'd like to bring up that we haven't talked about today? Anything coming up with the city that you'd like to publicize?
Well, I would say just regarding the Complete Streets Plan, we are having public input meetings on that coming up in October. The dates haven't been released yet, but I would encourage folks to keep an eye out for those if they have input. You know, we'd love to hear input sooner rather than later on anything we do. And so keep an eye out for that, too. This Tuesday, we have the town budget meeting. So I know it's not even November yet, but we're already starting to plan for the budget for next year. So town budget meeting is the first step there. That's where the public can really give their input on what they want to see more of in the budget or less of. For some reason, people only ever have ideas for what they want to see more of. But but input on the budget is always helpful, too. So that's coming up. What else is coming up that's interesting?
You have a 13th Street project that's going to be starting between Harding and, I believe, Ridgewood.
There's some project there that will include a block extension of the bicycle path as well, which will be nice. That'll connect the bicycle path that pretty much ends there at Brook Ridge. It'll connect it to Northwestern, I believe. And that'll be really nice because that just goes again to completing our network. So,
well, we are unfortunately out of time. Thank you for joining us again today.
Oh, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Ames City Councilwoman Bronwyn Beatty Hansen, and we will see you on the radio again.
And you have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Dennis Hart and I have been your host today. I'm Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for being with us today. Earlier in the show, we heard from Lynn Ballard, owner of the Haunted Forest, and Bailey Ballard, who is one of his supervisors of the forest, and Jennifer Brockpoller, director of Ames City Arts Council. Ames Community Arts Council. Today's show was engineered by Cynthia McClure. Thank you, Cynthia. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI. Also remember that you can hear it online at khoifm.org live, and also a link for listening later on with links to guests and information you heard during the program. Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris, from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show. So if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. So come and join the Local Talk team. Stay tuned for Headline News and Democracy Now! At 8 a.m. and Morning Masterpieces at 9. And remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com. Support for KHOI comes from Mary Greeley Medical Center, providing inpatient and outpatient services on a continuum of care, located at 1111 Duff Avenue in Ames. Find out more information at www.mgmc.org. That's mgmc.org.